Please note that all information and content on UK Health Radio and our blog are provided by the authors, producers, and companies themselves and is only intended as additional information to your general knowledge and does not substitute professional medical advice or treatment. So please do not delay or disregard any medical advice received due to information gathered on the UK Health Radio.
UK Health Radio, real feel-good radio.
Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians. The companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio. Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour, a very special Health Tech Hour. We are broadcasting live from Rewired in Birmingham. And Rewired, if you don't know, is one of the largest health tech conferences. It's definitely the leading health tech conference in the UK. And we, this show, Health Tech Hour, is very, very lucky to be a media partner of the event. And part of that is we get to do a completely unique podcast at the show. And we are going to be speaking to three amazing people over the next hour. And I hope you love it. So let's get straight into it. Thank you very much for joining if you're listening live. Thank you very much for listening if you're listening on any of the podcast channels. We get downloads in over 40 countries every single month. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce my first guest, Alex Gwitha from the Health Foundation.
Hi, great to be here.
Right, how's your WeRide going? It's Alexander Lawrence because it's Hayley Gwitha.
Yeah.
See, look, I already messed up my show. This is why we rehearse. So, Alexander Lawrence, nice to see you. How are you?
I'm great, yeah, it's great to be here. I was trying to work out how many rewires I've been to now. I think this is probably going to be number 5 or 6.
Number 5?
Maybe.
Okay, what was the first one like? Is it smaller? Has it gotten bigger? Gotten smaller?
Well, I used to work at a trade association called Tech UK, which had over 350 health tech companies in membership. We represented them to government, regulators, etc. And so I used to know pretty much everyone here, and I'd walk around and know pretty much every stall and just spend the whole day bumping into members, which was great. It definitely feels bigger now and I definitely know less people.
Okay, well, I guess that's progress in some way. So you recently, in the last couple of days, I believe, published some research, and it's that research that you're here to talk about, which I think is, well, if I walk around the conference, I can see that there are so many businesses involved in electronic patient records.
Yes.
Right, in some way, shape, or form. And a lot of them say something very similar from what I can tell. So what is it that you're kind of here to talk about and your area of interest?
Yeah, absolutely. So the research came out this morning, so it's hot off the press.
Yep.
Published by the Health Foundation. It looks at a staff survey we did of over 1,700 NHS staff across all different care settings, asking them about their experience of using electronic patient records. We wanted to ask staff about this for a few reasons. Firstly, because EPRs are almost at 100%.
You know, is that right?
You'll keep seeing those headlines of, you know, 3 trusts left, 2 trusts left.
Okay.
Those ones, yeah. So we get to reach 100%, but we're almost there.
Okay.
And that kind of provided an impetus for us to think, you know, all this money and all of these resources and this effort and attention has been spent on getting to 100%, but has anyone thought about what happens next? So
right.
We've got these EPRs in place, but how are we actually using them? What benefits are we actually hoping to get out of them? Where are we going? So that prompted us to do it. And also, you know, staff experience it's such a good metric for whether tech is actually working well on the ground, and I think you can't underestimate that.
Okay, and when we talk about an electronic patient record, just for everyone listening, because we're a broad church, you know, there's all kinds of different people that listen to the show from all kinds of different countries. What are we really talking about at the core? Like, what's the simplest definition of it?
We are talking about the systems that are in GP surgeries, in hospitals, that ambulances use, any care setting, basically. They're using systems, they're inputting your data into those systems, and they're functioning as electronic versions of paper health records, basically. That is what they are in their simplest form. In their kind of higher form, they can do much, much more than that. They can help optimize workflows, they can triage patients, they can send you appointment reminders, you can integrate AI tools into them. But in their simplest form, that's about it.
And there's a lot of talk, or there was a lot of talk in the NHS 10-year plan and around that time, that this sort of concept of an electronic patient record sort of is the beginning of the unlock of massive efficiency gains, massive prevention gains. What's your kind of take on that, and how far away we are from that sort of alleged utopia?
Yeah, we're definitely not there yet. I think that would be hard to argue. I don't think that electronic records in the state in which they are in the majority of organizations are providing significant productivity gains yet.
Interesting.
But we did some work last year looking at a really advanced healthcare provider in the US, looking at their electronic patient record system, which they've spent billions of pounds.
Billions.
Billions.
Wow.
Billions investing in, and around 15 years.
Wow.
And that is delivering significant productivity gains.
What areas are those productivity gains coming, roughly?
It's being used as a very sophisticated clinical decision-making tool.
Oh, really?
To help clinicians. It's being used to coordinate care across different parts of this provider, which has lots of different hospitals and care settings under its umbrella. It's being used for quality improvement tools, population health analysis, all of these things.
Which is kind of like what the 10-year plan said would be the thing that happens here. So how many patients roughly is that system, or that example, do you know? Like, how does it compare? It's got to be in the millions, right?
Because it's in the millions, but I can't pretend that I can remember the exact figure.
No, but it's basically a decent population size is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So do you feel like we're potentially underestimating the scale of investment and the timeline here to unlock this thing? Unlock these benefits.
I think that when EPRs were first introduced in the UK and we set out on this mission to digitize our records, that the NHS thought that, you know, it was kind of a natural modernizing step that needed to happen, and not much thought was put into it beyond that in terms of the specific benefits we wanted to see, the specific areas where it might improve productivity.
Yeah.
And the amount of investment, both kind of training of staff, which is a really important point that came up a lot in our survey, training of staff, the money that you need to spend to update the hardware that these systems are running on, all of these kind of things was underestimated.
There might be legacy hardware that just can't run the version.
Yeah,
wow.
Not fast enough Wi-Fi.
Yeah, not enough.
All of
not
these
enough
things.
Wi-Fi. Yeah.
So yeah, 100%. Wow. The scale of investment needed to like optimize these systems, which is a bit of a kind of, it's not a very nice word to use, but it is like the right, it is a useful word, but essentially, you know, how effectively these systems are running, how useful they are, the investment you need to get them working well is considerable.
And I was chairing a panel earlier today, which was on AI. It was really interesting. So Joe Zhang and Jess Morley, who are two of the leading researchers in the field of AI, they were kind of delivering a reality check. Sort of, they framed it as like reality versus snake oil in the AI space. And one of the things that came up was the vendor lock on the EPR system, i.e. a lot of the data that supposedly will unlock these benefits is actually locked down in a vendor system. Like, how has that come out in anything that you've been looking at or thinking around?
Yeah, it has. It came up both in the qualitative research we did last year. We found that a lot of trusts told us that it was much harder to access the data stored in their EPR system than they had anticipated or than they had been told.
Yeah.
And then it also came up in our staff survey in the sense of over 70% of staff telling us they have to use more than one system on a daily basis, and kind of fragmentation and differences between systems being the number one barrier to like more effective use of EPRs, which is a wider point, but kind of speaks to that problem of data access and interoperability.
Yeah, because it's all well and good putting in place an EPR, and EPRs should exist just because it doesn't make any sense to use paper. I mean, like, so fundamentally there should be an EPR. But actually, when you're looking to go to the secondary and tertiary levels of benefit of an EPR, that's when you get into what you're talking about, which is the interoperability, the walled garden, the vendor lock, and all that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's those kind of more complicated uses, more complicated functionalities, where we think and where other countries have shown us, you start to get productivity benefits.
Yeah.
You start to make life easier rather than harder for staff on the ground. Patient care starts to improve, all of those stuff.
I've been shocked at how many companies here basically say they do the same thing in this hall. Like, it looks like there's a lot of people roughly doing similar things. So it must be quite difficult for trust to be able to differentiate between all of these providers. I don't know if that's come up as well in your research about like how staff deal with things that look and sound very similar but might not actually be similar.
Yeah, we didn't look at kind of different vendors specifically. Like, we didn't ask for staff views on one vendor versus another. But I think that there is a significant lack of procurement expertise on digital health generally within trusts. Like, I think that's something that potentially the centre could help a lot more with.
Do you know what? I love talking about this issue of procurement. So I sit on the NHS England SME Advisory Board, and that's across all SMEs. So, like, yes, there's some digital people like PocDoc, but there's also, like, for example, one of the guys that sits on it, Danny. Danny is the king of milk in the Southwest. So Danny delivers all of the milk to all hospitals in the Southwest. So if you're listening in the Southwest of England, you're having a Costa coffee in a hospital, Danny delivered your milk. So I think, to that point, NHS trusts and NHS institutions are actually pretty good at procuring hardware, physical items, right? Like NHS supply chain, et cetera, unit pricing, all that stuff. I think they're not great at procuring stuff where it's more service-based, and definitely not digital. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, we published a report, I think this time last year, called The Cost of Digitizing the NHS, which is a fantastic report. Everyone should go and read it.
Yeah.
Where we basically tried to calculate how much money it would cost if the government basically fulfilled all of the promises it's made on what
That's
it's going to
great...
do.
I love that exam question.
It was hard.
If the government if the government did everything it said it would do, how much would that cost?
Yeah, a lot. Spoiler
That's
alert,
a great
a lot.
Question.
Sorry, I've completely forgotten how
That's
I got
okay.
onto
it was
this.
Me laughing. It was you. they published a paper around how much it would cost, and it was to do with procurement of services.
One of the problems that highlighted, or one of the recommendations that came out of it, was around changing the way that things are funded in terms of like capital funding to suit more like software as services, essentially.
Right.
We just found that it was totally not suited.
I completely agree with you, and I actually think this is one of the things that I harp on consistently about to anyone that will listen, which is the digital health industry as an industry needs to be learning from people that have gotten really, really, really good at managing procurement with the NHS around physical items. And we should be learning from those people, Danny the King of Milk and whoever supplies the bog roll and all these people. They supply like billions of units of these things every single year. Somehow, somewhere, we need to try and figure out some working groups as to how we can take that and apply it over there. Because even supply chain, NHS supply chain, which I'm sure you've heard of, that only works in hospitals. The NHS supply chain only applies in a hospital setting. So it is completely irrelevant to the vast majority of the NHS. So I think there's a lot in there.
No, I think that's really interesting, because I think people often focus on how different procuring tech and digital is, but what you're saying is there's actually a lot to learn from existing ways
100%.
Of working.
Well, also, my take on anything in life is like, let's go figure out who's done it better or who's doing it really well, and then go and see what we can learn.
Yeah.
I think that there's a tendency, and I don't know why, but I've definitely noticed it within the UK digital health industry at large, and the kind of counterparts in the NHS system, like who look at digital health, to try and just reinvent the wheel constantly.
Yeah, 100%. Like, we're always trying to look, especially at kind of international examples. I think because the NHS is unique in lots of ways. Sometimes there can be hesitancy to learning from other countries, particularly with the US, and a lot of that hesitancy is warranted. And you always have to kind of caveat when you're saying the US did this, why can't we do it? Nevertheless, like with the EPR example, it's so useful that they're ahead of us, you know, because we can look at what they did wrong and what they got right and try and emulate that. And actually, when it comes to electronic patient records, the US took a fairly kind of NHS-y approach. They had a national, they called it a meaningful use program, which they said, this is how we're going to get to meaningful use of EPRs. This is where every single provider needs to be by this date. They had financial incentives.
I love this, okay, because we're within PocDoc, we're lucky enough to now be looking ahead to submitting to the FDA for our US launch, which is super exciting.
Amazing.
Yeah. The FDA has blown me away in terms of its efficacy versus, and it's along the same lines, which is like people like to stereotype the US healthcare system. And I don't disagree with, you know, probably a lot of the things that you wouldn't disagree with around health inequity and costs and all that kind of stuff. But there are some things that they are so much further ahead of. Like the FDA, for example, is a government-run institution with guaranteed timelines on responses and approvals or denials. You can sit down with the people that are going to analyze your submission in advance, etc. It costs a few thousand dollars to go through because it's government funded. And you compare that to the system here or in Europe or in the UK where we've privatized medical device regulation. So it's not nationalized. So you have to go find a private provider who's interested in profit. And every time they question your file, you have to pay them. And there's no timelines. So I completely agree with you. I think that like this blanket, the NHS, the way the US does healthcare is bad, is really dumb.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the MHRA is thinking at the moment about how it approaches regulating AI. We're acting as the research partner the MHRA on that piece of work. And I think that international examples are going to form a really important part of that. So yeah, you spoke to the FDA example. And I know that they've also got a kind of sort of fast track pipeline for innovative devices that they think that the system has a real need for.
Yeah, they're much more interested and much braver around making bets or sort of accelerating things that they think will help. Then for some reason, I don't think we're really brave enough to provide those. It's not to say everyone in that pathway will get approved. It's just to say that, well, our business needs, our customer needs are this. So if you're in that bucket, we're going to accelerate the analysis. I just don't feel like we're there yet at any level. And I think part of it is because we haven't centralized that regulatory pathway. It's been privatized. So those private companies are for-profit companies. So they're going to do whatever maximizes their profit. So that's why I think a big difference is, unfortunately, and that goes across all of Europe. All European governments have outsourced medical device regulation.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting to think about. Are there any European countries that you look at and think they're doing something interesting? Obviously, there's a certain amount that's centralized across the EU, but
yeah.
You know, there's like DiGA in Germany or whatever.
So here's what's really interesting. What governments in Europe and the UK can influence all happens after you've been approved. They are unable to influence approval because it is not in their gift to approve. Because the people that approve is this network of about 60 notified bodies. BSI is the one that everyone knows here, but there's loads. And you have to apply to them for your approval. And it's that notified body that would then update MHRA, etc. The MHRA plays no role whatsoever in the actual approval of any device. It doesn't play a role at all. So what you find is governments are actually quite good at, European governments like DiGA is a really good example in Germany. That's a really good program that applies after you've been approved.
Yeah.
It's around uptake and funding and scale, and it makes total sense. Nobody is able to influence actually speeding up the actual regulatory pathway. And that's a really thorny question that no one's wanted to get their hands around.
Yeah.
Ever. I've been talking about it for a few years now, and no one wants to go near it, which is really interesting.
We obviously we did this EPR polling, which was just with NHS staff, but we also do much wider public polling. We do this nationally representative survey where we ask questions about how the public feel about technology, data, AI, and we do it every year so we can track kind of changes in attitude and stuff. That also came out a couple of weeks ago. And one of the questions that we asked this year around kind of AI and regulation is kind of what trade-offs people are willing to accept when you ask them questions about regulation versus speed of adoption.
Yeah.
And I won't go into the results in detail, but essentially, like, I think it's much more complicated than people would anticipate. You know, it really depends on what kind of scenario that particular device is intended for.
100%.
What the trade-off is, like how long is the waiting list if that device isn't used, these kinds of things. And also it varies a lot by gender, by age, by socioeconomic group.
Yeah.
So as you said, it's a really thorny issue that someone, hopefully the MHRA is going to get their hands around.
If the MHRA could take control back of ACT, if they could replicate the FDA, that would be a huge step. But I would love to dig into that at some point, but that's a whole show in and of itself. So, Alex, thank you so much for coming on. Where do people go to find out about all of these papers and such, and if they want to do some research themselves?
Yeah, so just go to the Health Foundation website and you'll find absolutely everything there. The EPR survey is on the front page today.
And what is the Health Foundation?
It's
all right, don't worry.
It's an independent charity and a think tank. We are working to build a healthier UK. We do a mixture of kind of in-house research, economics, data analysis, funding programs, and campaigns.
Brilliant. Alex, thank you
so much for coming on.
Thanks for coming on.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So you're kind of a fixture at Rewired, right? Like these are your people, you know what I mean?
It's very kind of you to say so. I do love the community.
Yeah.
And actually, I'm going to use the phrase communities.
Yep.
Because this is a show full of tribes.
Oh, 100%.
Lots of tribes.
Yeah.
You've got the CIO network,
yeah.
CCIO network, and CNIO network. So Digital Health convenes them. But you've got lots of other networks. Clinical safety officers are here.
Yeah.
Everyone's coming together. The Shuri Network is here.
What's the Shuri Network?
Oh, so the Shuri Network is a wonderful group of people who believe that women of color, so the intersection, they should be represented more in digital health.
I don't disagree with that premise.
And actually, you find that they aren't. Sometimes they're not given the opportunities. They're not given the chance to shine. So the Shuri Network, lift as you climb.
Oh, nice.
Go higher as you grow. And they're such a supportive group. Amazing. I'm lucky to be an advisor to them.
Yeah.
And Rewired has been a friend to the Shuri Network and a friend to so many communities.
I think that's a really good point. Of all the conferences, this is the one that I know where it really calls out the different communities. So it calls them out by name. So the CCIO, the CIO, the integrated care, the Shuri. Okay. Whereas other conferences, they sort of, there's a bit more thematic, you know what I mean? Whereas this one actually, you can come here and definitively find your people.
You're so right. And I'm going to make a distinction that's probably unfair.
Go for it, man. I'm here for it.
You've got lots of companies that are events companies trying to do healthcare.
Oh, yeah.
Digital health is a group of people who do healthcare as their main thing.
Yeah.
Doing an event.
Yes.
And so they're from the inside out.
Yeah.
Rather than from the outside in.
Yeah, it does feel like, it's always felt a Rewired that this is sort of the industry's conference.
Yeah.
You know, this is like for people to come together and to feel free to talk to each other. So how many panels are you on this time? Three, is it? Four? What is it?
I'm lucky to be on the committee.
Right.
So if there's a gap, your hand up.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those.
So you're on later talking about AI, is it? Or what are you talking about?
I'm on tomorrow and I'm on an imaging one.
Oh, yes. Imaging. Yeah.
And I'm also on the closing panel.
Okay.
When it comes to digital transformation and how do we get to the 10-year plan?
Ah, so let's talk about that because I have heard a rumor. I'm not sure this could be a fact. I get confused with rumour and fact sometimes in the NHS. But it could be a fact, it could be a rumour, that the government is about to announce that it is about to release the funding to deliver the 10-year plan. What is your take on this issue?
I think that we have got the same problem for many years. Organisational memory gone.
Yep.
And so we have to reinvent the wheel.
That's happening a lot.
Right. So as an entrepreneur yourself, you'll find that sometimes you're trying to sell to somebody and you're having to persuade them of something. And you're thinking, but why didn't they get that? That was the same problem last year, year before.
Well, a lot of these problems are the same problems that we've had for a long time.
Right, cyclical. So if you end up losing the staff who've got the digital transformation skills and they've got the experience, what happens to your ability to do it next year?
Yeah.
that's going, right? And yeah. that's where my main concern is. I think we're losing organizational memory. You can give me money, you can't give me time, you can't give me experience.
Well, I think that's a really interesting take on, look, and I'm not going to get into the cuts and things like that, because we're supposed to be, it's a positive conference talking about future and excitement and things like that. However, that being said, I think people, and you can tell me if you think I'm wrong, but people talk about digital transformation as if it happens digitally, and it doesn't. It happens by people doing stuff, you know? Like, you can't just, yes, it's digital technology, but someone still has to actually get off their backside. So, like, PogDoc's a great example where, like, you know, last week we were at a Sikh temple in the Black Country, right? And we upskilled local community workers to deliver screenings in the temple during prayers to a particular group that's considered to be underserved. Yes, that's part of digital transformation, but it was delivered by quite a lot of people, right? And if those people hadn't been there, it wouldn't have happened.
You've hit the nail on the head on an idea that people don't often have a name for.
Right.
And I'm a Ronald Heifetz nerd.
Okay.
So I look at adaptive leadership.
Right.
How do you change things? Can you anesthetize people and say, we're going to freeze you and we're going to impose change?
Yeah.
Or do you get them to be not only the problem
yeah.
and the solution at the same time? Because yeah. they are the problem. If they don't move, you get nothing.
Absolutely.
But if you treat them as partners in what's happening and then they lead it, the adaptive leadership is for yeah. you to say, look, I'm on the balcony looking down, helping people change themselves.
Well, I think that in my experience, obviously I don't come from a healthcare background, as you know, so I'm kind of, you know, the last few years doing this, learning as I go. So this, again, might be off base, but I think the healthcare system, because it's not just the NHS, there's the pharmacy and everything, the wider system, I think is uniquely misplaced to accept top-down change mandates, rightly or wrongly. Like, and there's been lots of examples of that. So if you're not able to work from the ground up and bring people with you and get people excited and coalescing around change, I think you're dead in the water. I just don't believe it comes from the top. I don't believe you can stand there waving to say, oh, we need to do this, and then people are going to do it.
I'm going to add, there's a health and care system, right?
Yes, yes, exactly. Yeah, and we always forget about the care sometimes.
And there's wider determinants of health and the neighbourhoods.
Yep.
I think that multi-stakeholder work requires ownership at the lowest possible level.
Yes.
Subsidiarity.
Really agree.
And that requires a new form of leadership, which is why I look at Heifetz for adaptive leadership.
Yeah.
And you look at what's going on, for example, Dr. Minal Bakai and her work in the neighborhoods. There are people out there who understand this implicitly.
Yeah.
You've got to delegate and devolve leadership down.
Yes. And you have to enable them to deploy. Enable them to deploy things that can actually have an impact. And yeah, no, I mean, I think a great example, though it's got a little bit spicy recently, but the AVT thing, right? So AVT really took off because GPs, and they were like, this is amazing. I'm going to try this. So those kind of things just come from the ground up. And now obviously we're in a whole kerfuffle around Microsoft and whatever else. But
can I add something on
yeah,
AVT,
please.
Right? So I'm lucky. I was at Great Ormond Street when we did the biggest trial. This is across London.
Is that right? Of AVT?
AVT.
Cool. I didn't know that.
And it was really, really well handled.
Was that with Tortoise? Was that the Tortoise
yes.
one? Yes.
And the way it was done was, because Paediatric Centre doing this, people thought it was going to be paediatrics only.
Right.
But they did everything. Adults, right. outpatient, ambulance, GP.
Right.
What they found was ED, emergency department, is yeah. where people wanted to hand over more.
Is that right?
And that's where they got the biggest benefit, because there was a goal of making that benefit happen. But then I thought to myself, but then the metrics are wrong.
Yeah.
The benefit isn't just about seeing more people. What's the clinical quality, for example?
Yes.
And sometimes we use the wrong metrics to measure things.
Oh, I agree with that.
And again, that's another imposition.
Yeah.
It needs to be self-defined sometimes.
Yes. But what's difficult here is that you obviously can't end up in the situation where you're trying to herd cats. So that it's a very difficult balance between centralizing around priorities to then allowing local deployment and local specialization, right?
There's some tension between what's central and what's devolved, right?
Yes.
And look, I'll go on the record and say this. I think in the UK, in the NHS, we've made a mistake sometimes of being too strong at the center and not enough, for example, out in the regions and so on. What we need to do now with the loss of what's happening at the center is redefine that and hold it.
Yeah.
And we're going to lose the people that would have helped us define it.
I think this people thing, because obviously you walk around Rewired, if anyone's ever come. It's an amazing, if you haven't come, you should come. It's a fantastic conference. The only one I would say that rivals this for me is Health in Amsterdam, which is a completely different vibe and a completely different sort of concept. But Rewired and Health in Amsterdam are really, really up there. So, but this is really all about for the most part, solutions, technology-driven solutions to problems, clinical, operational, whatever they happen to be. But where is the discussion around the people, do you think? Do you think that we're missing that sort of transparency around this people-based discussion? Or what do you think?
Elephant in the room is that no one wants to be overly critical when we already know the answers are not going to change.
Right.
But, yeah, the overall feeling across the conference for the last 2 or 3 years has been, why don't we help the people do the jobs better? Because technology is never going to be the full answer. In fact, when it comes to transformation, there's this argument that half of the money that you need, maybe even more than that, needs to go on the transformation rather than the solution.
I mean, we've seen this firsthand again. I mean, in so many ways, what we realized when we started PocDoc was really that one of the things that had held back point of care screening as a concept, it wasn't just in cardiovascular disease, but across the board, was that it was dominated by people that made plastic boxes and dropped off plastic boxes on the door of the customer and then left. And we're like, well, you know, you've spent £5,000 on my box, thank you very much. If you want more consumables, here's my consumable team. But that was so far away from delivering impact, and that the organization itself needed so much support to deploy.
We now need to move to this era where people are empowered, as you said, right? Empowering people isn't what we are used to doing in healthcare. We're used to doing things to people.
Yes.
And I think that's the culture shift that I'm hoping will happen.
Yeah.
And technology is now moving so fast.
Rapid.
Where people are saying, I'm going to take control away from those who used to have power.
Yep.
So there's now this tension of, I used to have power, I want to hold on to it.
Yeah.
And those saying, no, I'm going to run away with it.
Yeah.
And they're going to use, for example, an LLM to look at their symptoms. There's a tension that no one's really resolved. I'm not quite sure where it's going to land up.
Well, I think this LLM thing is a really interesting one. So my wife put this on LinkedIn recently, but she's just sadly been diagnosed with breast cancer about 6 weeks ago. So she comes from an oncology background. And so she's very well versed in oncology, very understanding of everything. But she uploaded she had a PET scan. And she uploaded the PET scan, which was in French, by the way, to Claude. And it gave her an unbelievably detailed breakdown that matched almost exactly what the oncologist later said. And so I think that there's to your point, this technology is moving so fast where it's going to be very interesting to determine where the regulatory empowerment, encouragement, concept kind of even comes in. It's like you have to completely reframe the debate.
This is really technical, but we've moved away from convolutional neural networks, right? CNNs.
Yeah.
To having foundational models.
Yeah.
And the problem with the foundation model is that it's ingested a lot of rubbish as well as a lot of good.
Yeah.
So fine-tuning is important. The fine-tuning of the foundation model requires tons and tons of work and effort and skill. But if someone manages to get that done, they don't know whether they're going to get the approvals, the regulation, and get the market.
100%. And also, actually, weirdly, now, we're a medical device company, so we've been through every single regulatory hoop and hurdle, etc. So I'm not saying this about us, but technology businesses don't willingly walk into regulatory environments. So they aren't going to want to do things that would accidentally qualify themselves as a medical device and bring themselves under that regulation. So it becomes very weird to figure out how it's going to end up, you know?
And you also look at the size of the market. So if you can go into a market that's less regulated, you're going to go for it. And at the moment, a lot of companies are saying, well, I'm going to stay in the US. I'm going to enjoy the US rather than come to Europe.
Yeah.
Because Europe is going to make it harder for me.
Yeah.
It might be safer, and that's debatable, but it's going to be harder and more expensive.
Yeah.
And that's why Europe is currently debating where its line should be.
I think also, I was talking about this with Alex, and then we'll do this, and then I've got our next guest coming on. But the FDA, so we're you know, going to be doing the US imminently, which is very exciting. And the FDA has blown me away with the quality versus Europe. So this isn't like NHS banging. It's actually got nothing to do with the NHS because it's the regulatory thing. But the FDA is a government-funded institution that by law guarantees when it responds. It has a maximum stop date for being able to provide you with an answer. Both of those things, by the way, are absolutely critical if you're trying to raise investment. So you can communicate accurately to investors and so on and so forth. And then they offer basically a pro bono service where you can speak to the examiners beforehand. So you can check your thesis before you submit. None of that exists in Europe. None. And so it's, and the other thing the FDA does is it's very, very clear about signaling winners. So it says, right, if you're developing this type of technology, we will accelerate your process. And I just feel like that would be amazing if we could get to that point in Europe. It's not to say that those people have an easier ride to get approved. That's not what I'm saying. It's not about lowering the bar on quality of the actual evaluation. It's just about accelerating and making it more transparent.
Europe needs to take a lesson from the entrepreneurial culture and the commercialization culture that the US does so well. Risk capital and the ability for an entrepreneur to just dream and go for it.
Yeah.
Because angel funding, VC funding, all of that's there. Europe is going to struggle if it doesn't match some of those things soon.
Yeah, I think so. Particularly on some of these bigger tech bets, I think it's going to struggle. So what are you, apart from your talks, what have you found most exciting that you've seen so far at Rewired?
I think there's two things that really come to mind. The first is that there are lots of companies here saying we are going to go for other markets.
Interesting.
Yeah, and they're saying it not because they doubt this is the market. It's because they know this is not the current market for them.
Mm-hmm.
If you stay in the NHS alone,
mm-hmm.
a lot of VCs are saying, look, we're just not going to be investing in you.
Yeah.
The NHS is not the solo market. So they're wondering what market there is. And problems in the GCC have sort of closed the door a little. I would argue that actually there's a lot of opportunity. It's never easy and it's never a good time to go to the GCC.
No, there's always hurdles.
But if you were to go now, you're showing solidarity at a time when you probably should be showing solidarity.
Right.
So I'd say don't close the door on the GCC. Singapore is an amazing market, but it's a reference market. It's how you get to other markets.
Yeah,
you're not going to make your money.
It's a couple of million people?
Small.
Yeah.
The US is always the eventual market.
It's the holy grail for any healthcare business. But it's a scary jump.
And so a lot of companies are saying this is the way they're going to go. Second thing that's really exciting, a lot of companies here are saying to me that they have found somebody within the system who, despite all the mess, believes in them and is willing to help them to get through. Mm-hmm. And so they're green shoots of recovery.
Yeah.
It's not all doom and gloom.
No, I don't. And I don't buy into this doom and gloom narrative. I mean, I was talking to someone earlier. Like, my take is that the NHS is always going to be in a semi-permanent state of restructure anyway. It's like a perpetual change thing. So if you let yourself get too synced up with those changes, you're going to go mad.
And you've got to listen to people who can give you the advice. Like, I love Liam Cahill, for
example. Oh, Liam, love that guy.
Right? And,
yeah.
And that's the kind of advice you need. Go at the right time,
yeah.
Make the right comment, have the right business plan. Those are the kind of things that you need. And if you listen to the right people, you will find success.
Perfect.
And NHS Innovation Accelerator, they're going to launch the new fellows.
Yeah, when's that? Is that later
tomorrow?
Today? Tomorrow, is it? Okay.
Great companies on there.
Yeah.
I won't give anything away.
POC Talks, we were here last year on that one. So Hassan, thank you so much for coming. Good luck with the speeches later. Good luck with the talks. And thanks a lot for helping co-produce an amazing conference.
Thank you so much.
Brilliant. Hayley.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hayley? Calling Hayley. Hi. How's it going?
All right, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, get your cans on. Get your headphones on.
Hello.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, how are you?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. Thanks
good.
For joining our show. Health Tech
Hour.
So how have you found Rewired so far?
Oh, I love it. It's like a family reunion.
Yeah?
Like me and all your old cousins. Some you like, some you don't.
Actual cousins? No. Like,
no.
Okay.
That's what it feels like because it's quite often the same faces. You know, we're quite a tight network, I think, across the digital health industry. So yeah, it's great.
And in your role in nursing, how have you interacted with digital health? Because this is predominantly a digital health-driven conference.
Yeah.
So what has your interaction been, and you know,
as
what's
in
your experience?
Digital health,
no, networks. Just in general, right? In your role and things like that, and how does nursing cross over with it? Because it's not always when you talk about digital health, I don't know if necessarily everyone always thinks about nurses and nursing, you know?
And they absolutely should. The biggest workforce in the NHS and
is that
the
right?
healthcare. Yeah, by far.
Is it?
Of course, yeah.
Wow.
You know, you think to probably every doctor, you've got probably 5-6 nurses.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That, wow.
I need to check on
the
actual
detail.
Yeah, I mean,
hold your feet to the fire.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So no, absolutely. The biggest workforce, the most consistent workforce. So you think, you know, you think of a normal ward in a hospital, the doctors and the consultants and everyone are obviously instrumental, but they come and go, but it's the nurses that are sat there next to the patient.
And why is it that nurses are more consistent?
I think it's just the nature of the role, isn't it? They're kind of place-based rather than follow the patients, if you like.
Interesting.
And I think they're key enablers to any digital change because of that consistency and the ability and the fact that they don't rotate necessarily through different trusts like our junior doctors would. And so they are often best placed to be that driver of change, even if it's not impacting them. So, you know, for example, in my trust, we're launching some digital documentation, and we're probably going to launch the nursing side first, because then once they get to grips with it, they can then help the doctors.
What type of documentation?
So basically digitizing bits of paper that they still use. So the nursing admission.
Okay.
So as the patient arrives, we'll then talk them through.
So that form that you write out and sometimes have to write out a few times.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Repetitive. But equally also exploring how AVT might support that. So let's just have a conversation with our patients and let the documentation do itself.
You know, that would be amazing.
That's the dream.
So you're open to that type of pathway conceptually?
Absolutely. Anything that helps take up, you know, documentation is hugely burdensome. I think it's been found that about 25% of a nurse's time is spent documenting.
Right.
So that's 25, that's a quarter of your day that you're not with your patient and not doing, you know, direct patient care. So anything to reduce that burden.
And like with this AVT thing, because it got, I don't know if you saw, but it got a bit spicy over the last couple of weeks with this Microsoft rumor.
Absolutely.
Which I'm still not sure whether it's a rumor or a fact.
Yeah, who knows?
But
we'll
knows?
We'll see.
We'll find out. But do you have any particular like dog in the fight, so to speak, or are you just focused on what's best for nurses and it'll be what it'll be?
Absolutely. I think are they much of a muchness? I don't know. I've not worked with them all, so I couldn't
just summed up the space so
I
eloquently.
Possibly comment, but I think for me, and this is in my role as Chief Nursing Information Officer, that is exactly, I advocate for our users, our colleagues, our patients, nurses, whoever. But you know, the tech, I don't and care who it comes from. It just needs to work.
Yeah.
And it needs to work for the user it is intended for. So.
And when it hits the nursing workforce, so this again, this is my impression having been seen by nurses and whatever, but this is very much a sample of one as opposed to like a professional sort of viewpoint. But nurses are often extremely hard workers with a huge burden on them. So how much time do you guys have, or do nurses have, to try stuff, new stuff? Or does it have to be like oven ready, good to go when it hits that front line?
It does, really. They have very little time. So I've been lobbying our trust to enable nurses to have some time as to be digital champions. So actually to have some dedicated time where they can come out, put their heads above the parapet and actually look
sort of muck about
at
with
what's
some stuff
happening.
And test some
yeah,
stuff.
Or even just tell us what their problems are, you know, so what does need fixing? So and quite often we have to be creative. So I can't, you know, the amount of arguments I have with our comms team about you cannot send a nurse an email. They're not reading them. They're not sitting at a computer waiting for the next email. So we need to go to them. We need to do roadshows. We need to go and infiltrate their handovers. We need to be creative. Put posters on the back of the loo door. You know, those sorts of things.
Interesting.
But that for me,
I was talking to Hassan a second ago about actual human change, people change.
Yeah.
Like that, I think that there's a big danger that people just assume that digitization is almost like a self-perpetuating cycle, which is if you use digital technology, then it deploys itself. When actually, you're talking about humans that are working a 10-hour, 12-hour shift? 12-hour shift on their feet, not checking their... And you've got to figure out a way to talk to them. Because they're the people you're saying will use the thing.
Absolutely. And it's got to work. It's got to be the best and easiest thing to do, because they will always choose the path of least resistance.
Right.
You know, we see it all the time, you know, with broken kit. Instead of reporting it, they'll just put a note on it, broken, and stick it to someone else's problem.
Because they're just
so busy. And like, that's not their priority. Their priority is caring for their patients and doing what they need to do for them during their shift.
So that's the reality of the front line.
Got to come down to that level, haven't we? And satisfy that. So that's why jobs like mine exist, really, is to try and bridge that gap between.
And how do you feel that that's going generally? Not a loaded question.
No, absolutely. That's fantastic.
I'm just curious as to sort of, because that's a hell of a job.
It is, and it's really tricky. Look, it comes in bits and starts, really. You know, some things we've done really well, some things we haven't. So I think it depends what it is. It depends how much resource we have behind it, how much time we get to do it.
Yeah.
And the impact and interest of people. So I think the AVT stuff has really sparked, I think it's new, it's everywhere, isn't it? It's big business at the minute. So people are engaged and probably will go over and above and do things in the extracurricular, you know, time.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's what the NHS is built on, really, is goodwill.
Yeah.
And so if you pitch it right and you get the right interest, then you're quite often a bit more successful.
So
it's varying.
Apart from AVT, what areas do you believe have the greatest potential unlock for nursing staff in general?
So I think we need to get the basics right. Mm-hmm. I don't think we're there yet. So we've digitised a lot of nursing processes, but we've just digitised nursing processes and we haven't transformed them.
Right.
And so, you know, we can talk about documentation is a massive thing. Medications administration, obviously, is a huge part of a nurse's workflow.
And so that means you. So the doctor or consultant said this person should be taking this.
Yes.
The nurse then has to go make sure they get that thing from the dispensary, or what?
It varies. So we're doing some innovative stuff with closed loop medication. So that is when you can basically track a medication from its production right through to it going to a patient by using barcode scanning.
Okay.
And the best and only way to do it properly, really, is to have unit dose dispensing. So the drugs are dispensed. So in some of our wards, we've got big, massive robots that dispense individual doses. So if you're prescribed paracetamol, it will give you the two tablets of paracetamol in a packet.
Yeah.
That then gets you push the trolley. So you know, if you think about a nurse doing a drug around their trolley, you push that up against the robot. It fills the drawers automatically, and so one drawer is for one patient.
Wow.
So as I come to you at the bedside, I'll scan your wristband, make sure I've got the right patient. It will open up the drug chart.
Okay.
I then take the drugs in that drawer. I'll scan those. It's then telling me I've got the right patient, the right drug at the right time at the right dose.
And that, what you've just explained there, strikes me, again, sample of one, not a nurse, but as requiring quite a lot of transformation work to, like, embed that.
Yes. So we've been at it about 2.5 years, maybe longer, years now, and we're on our 10th ward.
Okay.
So it's taken a lot of time.
And what impact have you seen?
So we've actually done some work with the University Hospitals of Birmingham, and we're starting to see results. We haven't had them officially yet, but it's quite stark. So, you know, the release of, like, whole-time nurses.
Oh, really? It's actually a time saving.
Time saving, efficiency, safety.
Safety. Safety, I completely get.
But also waste management. So actually, the ability for us to rotate and give them the drugs that are going out of date the soonest. You don't waste them. You get less errors.
Interesting. Like stock control and stuff.
Yeah. So it's massive for pharmacy. Yeah.
Yeah, so did this kind of come over a little bit from the pharmacy space?
Yes, so it's been completely driven by pharmacy, actually. We've got a nurse on the project team, which they tried to remove, and I was like, we are having a nurse on this. Nurses are mostly impacted. So yes, it's been mostly driven by pharmacy, and certainly the return on investment we're seeing mostly there with, the reduced wastage and things and the better stock control. But, you know, to see the kind of probably unintended good consequences for our nursing teams.
And what's the satisfaction amongst nurses for stuff like
it's
that?
It's mixed. And it's interesting because, you know, we've now, which is quite exciting for us, because we've now got the evidence to say it's not taking longer, but the perception is that it takes longer.
Interesting.
Because it's new and it probably, the actual act of filling the trolley and actually giving the drugs probably does take a little bit longer, but actually when you factor in the fact you haven't then had to go and look for the drug chart and you haven't had to go and check next door for stock because everything's there and ready.
Nothing's run out.
Cumulatively, it's saving a huge amount of time.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I think it really is a testament about that need to evidence things. So we're really good in the NHS of making changes and we're getting better at it and we're doing digital transformation, but we don't ever spend enough time going back and looking at what we've done and have we done it well? Is it working? Is it working as intended?
What I think about that, what you've just explained there, is a really great example of sort of a common sense approach to digital transformation.
I mean, common sense, who knew?
Well, yeah, but like somehow, somewhere, you or some group of people were given or fought for a long timeline, 2.5 years, and the ability to go slowly, like 10 wards over 2.5 years, that's not setting any records in terms of speed, but actually you did it right. And now you've got great data or about to have great data.
Yeah.
So just how can we replicate that more and more places? Because I feel like there's just a sometimes a tendency to sort of like do a small pilot quickly, yeah, but then not follow through, or just chop and change and
absolutely. And that's the pace we normally work at, I must admit, you know, that chop and changing, just quick decisions, just get it out there. So I think I think you know, it's important to say that the research that we have done has been in partnership with the supplier, so they funded some of it, which
of course
obviously
helps.
Is important, but I think the fact that it's been a higher education gives it real rigor and gives it the kind of in-depth of research that we needed. So maybe there's something in that actually, as we contract with suppliers, there's something in it to say, you know, you will help us fund some evaluation. Maybe there's something that you think about there.
I think it's really
because it only benefits the supplier as well, doesn't it?
But the fact that you believe, I'm going to go on a bit of a rant now, so apologies. But the fact that you believe that a supplier should have to be educated about the value of evaluating their technology is shocking to me. You know what I mean? Like that, if you're a supplier selling into what health is B2B sales, straight out, the B2B enterprise sales, right? Like if you're selling robots, for goodness sake, that's an enterprise sale.
Yeah, yeah.
And the fact that you would have to be educated, for example, around why it might be good to run an evaluation is insane to me. And I feel like there's a lot of, if I could wave a magic wand, I would love to be able to inject a bit of realism sometimes into the entrepreneurial culture around digital health. Yeah. And like, just because you built the thing, that's table stakes.
Yeah.
Building the thing is like, well, if you don't have a thing, then don't talk to anyone.
Yeah.
So I don't know, I just feel like there's something there, but I don't know if you found the same thing.
No, absolutely. And like I say, I think I think it would benefit the supplier because then they have the evidence. You know, we all know as soon as a supplier starts talking to us in the NHS, it's like, well, where else are you live? What's the evidence? Well, how does it work? You know, so
who
it
can
feels
I talk
like
to?
A no-brainer.
It's like, who else can I talk to that's using your robot?
So actually, if it's built into contracting and the kind of supply of things, that you will come back and you'll evaluate and you'll tell us what's working, what's not, it surely benefits everyone. And maybe it's because they don't want the negative things to come out, I don't know, but surely then they're just things you can build on.
Well, and I think about PopDoc, for example, which is the company that I run, you know, some of the harshest feedback we got was obviously very in the early days from NHS people that were nurses and community workers and things like that were using it, and it was given in an extremely blunt way, but we knew that would happen because it was the first version of the product.
But you want that, surely, because you want it to work for who you're intending it to
like
be used
by. Can stick your head in the sand and that's all well and good, but then it won't get any better and you won't scale and you won't grow. So I just think it's a really, if you think about in the United States, for example, and like they're all about solving customer problems. Like the customer's king or queen, you know? So I just think maybe there's a little bit of that needs to come over here.
And I think you hit the nail on the head there. It's about solving problems. So it's not about creating something because you think it's, you know, you actually need to solve a problem.
Yeah.
We're not great at that in the NHS. You know, we are, especially with the likes of me, who's a bit of a nerdy nurse that goes out to things like this and sees the next shiny thing and I want it.
Sure.
And then I try and find a use case for it. But actually, you know, we need to be speaking problem solving rather than just putting something in for something's sake.
How good do you think, you could talk about nursing or you could talk about the healthcare system in general, I don't mind. How good do you think that you are at signalling the problems that you need to be solved the most?
Bad.
Okay.
We don't often.
All right.
We don't often understand them. I think we don't spend the time understanding them. So, I mean, case in point, we're doing some work, as I said, with documentation, our EPR, and we've now come to the point where we were like deciding whether to deploy or not. We've realised we haven't done that work. We haven't gone to understand what the true pain points are, what the problem is we're trying to solve. So lots of things are made on assumptions, sitting around a table talking about it, but actually when we go out and see it in action, that's where you get the truth. So yeah, we definitely need to get better at that. And again, it's the upfront investment, isn't it? You know, and the planning and building that in so that process mapping can't be understated. So you want your current state, then what you're aiming for, and then the steps in between.
And do you feel like there are individuals in the system that are able to deliver that sort of process mapping? Does that sort of exist, or is it a bit of a thing that gets forgotten about?
Yeah.
It's a genuine question.
No,
I don't know.
Right. So there are, and I think this is a skill. You know, you do need to invest
skill.
In it.
Yeah. Especially in a system as complex as the healthcare
system.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I've seen some recently, I'm like, well, it's great. It talks through how I use the tech, but it doesn't talk about anything else around the periphery. You know, there's that complexity.
Yeah.
So it is a skill, and I think it's something we don't invest in very well. I think where I've seen it work really well is where you join up, like, transformation. quality improvement.
Okay.
So that's kind of, it's the same sort of methodology.
Yeah.
You know, you define your problem, you map it out, and how do you fix it? So
yeah.
Seeing really good results where those two teams come together. And actually, we were just talking about it on a panel I was just on, and they shouldn't be two separate teams. Like,
what's
it should be
thing?
Should be. And you know, we've talked very much a lot in the past as digital leaders that actually shouldn't be digital transformation. It's just transformation.
Yeah, it's improvement.
And one day
I completely
it won't
agree with you. Like, calling it digital transformation is such it's very misleading.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just about improving stuff.
Controversially, a few years ago, questioned that will the CNIO role still be? You know, will it have an does it have an expiry date? And
maybe.
I think it does, because it will just be change. It won't be digital change, and there won't be a need for this isolated person championing the digital, because that will just be the norm.
Yeah, I do think that there's an element of we have to try and shift all this into BAU.
Of course, and make it everyone's business. It's not just
digital
ours.
People.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not us doing it to you. It's a partnership.
Right, so we've got a couple of minutes left. What are you most excited about seeing at Rewired, or you may have already seen?
I am most excited, I think, about the suppliers. I like going around and seeing what's new.
The new shiny stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And like I say, catching up, the networking thing is so powerful.
Yeah.
These jobs that we're in tend to be quite lonely. Especially like the kind of leadership roles, there tend to be only one of you in a trust trying to deliver mountains, and not everyone gets it. So, you know, it's nice having the networks.
Yeah.
So that's always my favourite bit.
Okay, good. And are you on any panels? Or are you...
Yes. So I was just on, so I'm the chair of the advisory CNIO advisory panel for digital health.
Okay.
So us as chairs have just done a panel session, and I'm also talking later about 4:30 about some work we're doing in the East Midlands.
Perfect. Well, Hayley, thank you so much
for
coming on the show. And have a great Rewired.
Yes, thank you.
See you later. Perfect. Right, so that was our Rewired special, and it was great to have you with us. So thank you very much for joining the three guests, Alex, Hassan, and Hayley. And we will be back again next week with another great show. So thank you very much for listening.